Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of the show, we will talk about what's new in personal computers and Macs. And we have an all-star lineup of guests for you this morning. I'm going to build them up, so stay tuned. Greg Klein is a staff writer with the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette. He writes about technology issues, also a variety of other features having to do with technology and non-technology in the News Gazette. He's also in charge of the Monday edition section of the paper called Circuits, and writes a column for that, has been a longtime computer user, so we're glad to have him with us. Also, Mark Zinzo and Phil Ryder, both from the Computing and Communication Services Office here at the University of Illinois. They are involved in helping a wide range of computer users get past the barriers that we all face with computer technology. And we're here to answer your questions. That's what this hour is all about. If you just got a new computer, maybe a new operating system, since the Windows XP is out and also OS X for the Mac, or new software, peripherals, a variety of other issues using the Internet, various issues that pertain to computers are welcome during this hour. If you have questions on those, give us a call. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you match the letters with the numbers, that's what you get. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states where our signal reaches, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. To everyone, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
We have a caller already lined up, but let me just first, something kind of important. I arrived this morning, and in my email, I get this this email newsletter from Computer World. The top story, FBI agency advises turning off vulnerable XP feature. Phil Ryder, what's that all about?
Well, XP is actually shipped with a number of vulnerabilities. And they can be patched. Actually, on the first day that XP shipped, there were a series of about 18 megabyte patch that XP had shipped without. Actually, on that first day, the patches covered a number of problems.
Yeah, a bunch of problems, you know, but this one in particular, the plug-and-play issue.
Yes, the plug-and-play issue actually allows other devices to tell XP what they are, and that compromises the operating system because anyone that is able to access this feature can gain access to the operating system and do what they like with it. That's definitely a serious security vulnerability there.
So somebody who knows what they're doing basically could hack into, if this is activated, any Windows XP computer that is connected to the Internet?
Potentially, yes. A lot of the problem is plug-and-play allows easy connectivity of peripherals.
Okay.
And plug-and-play, if allowed to access your system, would allow someone to potentially do what they like, tell the machine what it is, and they can get in sort of through a back door.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but there is a patch available for this. Is there a patch available for this?
Actually, I'm not sure. I believe the patch has corrected the problem, but I don't have this in my notes here.
Okay.
I'm sure there's a patch that they have released a patch to correct the problem until they find, you know, something else, which is not unlikely.
Right. But in the meantime, people can avoid being vulnerable by essentially turning off the plug and play feature of their operating system.
Or running Windows Update.
Windows Update with the patch would fix that.
Okay. But it's something that people should definitely know about, especially if they're, you know, as so many of us are connected via a cable modem or something to the Internet.
Well, yeah. Certainly. I mean, there's a number of other problems with XP. And, I mean, especially around Christmas time, if you've got the shiny new machine with XP preloaded on it, a lot of users don't know that connecting to Windows Update for, you know, critical update patches is very important, preventing, you know, problems with your machine and vulnerabilities and security bugs.
And even the computer professionals are not keeping track of every mistake Microsoft makes. As much as many people like to jump and deride them, there are just too many. And it's just far easier to rely on the update service or to check the Microsoft security site for the latest information.
Okay.
And use an antivirus product to close that security vulnerability as well.
And also update that regularly. Those are important things. That is good advice for people who just got that new computer for Christmas. You ought to get in the habit of regularly running Windows Update to get those patches for things like those security holes as well as general operating system bugs. And you ought to have a virus protection program in there, and you ought to get in the habit of regularly updating that.
Okay.
And if I could just, on the virus subject, just mention that students, faculty, and staff at the university are covered by a university site license. I've talked to a lot of students and faculty that have gone out and purchased computers and been sold antivirus software that is going to expire on them, and the university has a package that is good for as long as they need it.
That's great. And they can get that from the website at CCSO?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good. Well, let's talk with our caller. We have someone who dialed in right away, so they must have something urgent on their mind. Let's talk with a listener on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Good morning. I'm looking for an answer to cutting down on the use of the mouse to save my wrist and my elbow. I noticed yesterday when I clicked on Get Messages, it said Control plus T. Are there other shortcuts I could use that would help me to reduce the number of clicks I have to make?
Yes, almost everything.
Uh-huh.
And you can. There are a couple of good ways to find out about those.
Uh-huh.
If you actually get a manual with the software that you're using, which is rarer and rarer these days, it'll often have a page or pages outlining those keyboard shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't get a manual, but you got like an electronic help file that's a PDF file,
mm-hmm.
There may be a page or pages like that in there. And also, when you pull down the menus, as you noted the other day, generally in the menus, if there's a keyboard shortcut, it will be listed out to the side.
Okay.
I think you're exactly right. It's a good thing to learn those. It keeps your hand off that mouse and saves wear and tear on your wrist.
Right.
And it's also faster.
Yeah.
Because it's a way of speeding up your computer without actually buying a faster processor or a new computer, because you're not moving your hands off the keyboard to grab that mouse all the time. You're doing things.
Yeah,
without that wasted movement.
I started out with WordPerfect 4.0, so I learned all that stuff and then was very frustrated when I had to go to a mouse, to do all those things on the keyboard, which seemed so easy to me.
I'd like to add a few notes on shortcuts. There are shortcuts covered in the Windows Help.
Mm-hmm.
Look under Keyboard or Shortcuts.
Okay.
If you also search like Google or some other search engine for Windows keyboard shortcuts.
Okay.
There's some very nice websites out there that summarize a lot of the general shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite is Windows E, which brings up the Windows Explorer.
Okay.
And another really handy shortcut is Windows D, which gives you a clear desktop.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very handy if you're running a setup program that tells you to close the other programs, but the setup program is taking up the entire screen.
Yeah.
Windows D will shrink everything down to the bottom of the screen so you can get back at something else, which is
great.
Really handy.
Okay. Thanks for the tip.
Thanks very much for the call.
Appreciate it.
All right. One thing in terms of just saving your wrist when, using a mouse and so forth, or other sorts of ergonomic issues. I mean, these things are pretty important. And the more time we spend using computers, just the physicality of the motions or the lack of motion, perhaps, that we're going through. Any tips on dealing with that?
A lot has to do with, particularly if there's problems with the way you hold your wrists, you can definitely be in a lot of trouble. Carpal tunnel syndrome seems to be a key buzzword these days, but it's definitely a serious problem. Hold your wrists as if I would advise to hold them almost as if you were playing a piano. You definitely want to be above the keys and not below them, not hinged up against your keyboard or any other.
Yeah, Well, I noticed that when mice came along, that at first, when I wasn't really used to it, my wrist would just kind of lock up. And after a while, I sort of got out of that.
Another ergonomic thing is simply to not work continuously all day long, but to take frequent breaks, stretch and flex your wrist, get a little exercise and motion other than the same mouse motion all the time.
Well, we were talking before about Windows XP. Is there anything more that we should say about that? We talked about Windows Update, which is a feature built into the operating system that, I wonder if everyone really knows about. I mean, there's so many features now in the operating systems that it's kind of hard to really, and like Greg Klein mentioned, things rarely come with manuals anymore. They're so complicated that even knowing the scope of the software is kind of difficult.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And part of the problem with, especially with the Windows operating systems, they're trying to cover such a broad base of peripherals and other components that no matter what they do, even they have a difficult time covering all the possible potholes. Some of them that have been problems with XP, power management, CD burning. There's been CDs that are unreadable or missing files or folders when they're read in Windows 98 or 95. Also XP, there's an update for that, a Windows update that corrects that. Specifically for XP, PowerQuest from Partition Magic came incompatible with XP. Partition Magic has to be upgraded to 7.0. QuickTime.
So you may need to upgrade your software in addition to various components of Windows XP.
That's correct. You may be purchasing something that's older. You may get a good deal on it. It may not work with XP. Mm-hmm. A lot of times they offer less expensive upgrades, but you have to pay attention to that and keep an eye so that you don't have to pay extra for what you... You don't buy the wrong software for your machine. And that's even with the most current antivirus software. Antivirus 2001, the Norton antivirus, that came, XP was not able to run it, and you have to upgrade to antivirus 2002, and that's approximately a $30 charge.
So, great.
Yeah, you have to watch for those things, definitely.
As the software gets more complicated, tries to do more things, I think there's also an effort on the part of developers to simplify in some ways for people, especially, a lot of people didn't come into computing doing command line, programming and so forth. And, so the interfaces are supposed to be easy to use, but it just seems that we're not there yet, that there's still a level of complexity that baffles many people. And I guess that's one reason I like doing these shows, because there's so much confusion out there that there's no end to the questions. Do you think we'll ever get to that point? I mean, is that where Windows XP is going, or Mac OS X?
I hope that, technology comes to the masses. I think it's headed that way, for sure. A big portion of that is I always like to think I have moderate experience with command line things growing up in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
I would say that a lot of people use computers without the intuition of what's behind them. And that's definitely something that needs to be looked at from a programming perspective and from, especially from a support perspective. A lot of people that are using machines, I've had people that I've spoken with in general that have been able to, or have told me that they believe the internet is somewhere on their hard drive. And that seems almost silly to some people. To other people, that seems perfectly fine because they don't have a concept of what the internet is, what it does. And it's really, from a general perspective, how would you know if it was coming from your machine or from somewhere else without knowledge of what a modem does or what an Ethernet connection is, et cetera.
Or what a server is.
Exactly.
I think the next big thing in user friendliness is going to be voice interaction, where you'll be able to speak to your computer and it's going to not really understand, but it'll be programmed so that it appears to understand what you're saying and be able to follow commands. You won't actually have to type. I mean, the dictation software is getting pretty good if you have the microphone an inch from your mouth. You know, it's not to the point where you can talk to your computer anywhere in the room like on Star Trek and you can say the light's 50% or whatever and tea hot.
With lemon.
That'd be nice.
How desperately I try.
But, you know, the hardware is growing far faster than the software. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be a long time before the software catches up. We're not going to see HAL in the next decade. We're not going to see a computer that can actually appear to think. And I think it's a long time before artificial intelligence. And I think artificial intelligence techniques is what it's going to take to make computers truly user-friendly. They're going to need to anticipate and be able to infer what people mean. And that's a long ways away. Computers are still very stupid. They're powerfully fast, and they're getting faster dramatically, but they don't have, computers don't think, they don't have a concept of what they're doing. They're merely following programmed instructions. And, you know, with Windows, I forget how many million instructions the operating system alone has, but these are all instructions written by fallible people. And anybody who's written software knows that for every instruction you give, there's a possible mistake that you didn't anticipate. And so it's going to be a very long time before software comes up until we get to the point where computers can write their own software based on input parameters from people. I don't think we're going to catch up that soon, and we're far ways away from that kind of technology.
Go ahead, Greg.
I think, Mark, the thing Mark said about the voice recognition being kind of the next big interface improvement is absolutely correct. And, you know, if you look at it now, we interact with computers in an unnatural fashion, okay? We're not born working with keyboards and mice and clicking menus and that kind of thing. We are born eventually. We're not born talking, but we quickly learn to talk and, interacting vocally. And I think that in relatively short order, you'll begin to see this appear more and more in your cell phone, in your handheld computer, mm-hmm. In your regular computer. And it won't be all that great at first, just like the iterations of it that are available now aren't all that great. But over time, as the power of computers increases and, the ability to, as Mark said, to get it to actually write its own software increases, it'll get better and better.
We're talking this morning about what's new in personal computers. We have three guests with us. Last heard was Greg Klein. He's a staff writer for the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette, writes on a variety of technology issues and other subjects. Also, Mark Zinzo and Phil Ryder from the Computing and Communication Services Office here at the University of Illinois. We have a couple callers waiting and time for others if you'd like to join us. If you have questions, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm thinking about buying a computer, and I was thinking of either AMD Duron or an Athlon processor. And I was wondering, for general computing, word processors, spreadsheets, databases, is there going to be much difference in the two?
Greg, no. You want to take that? No. Greg says no.
In a word, no.
What if I...
You know, if you're talking about, you know, doing the basic stuff that most people like to do, word processing, you know, using the internet, maybe do a spreadsheet or a little Quicken for your personal finances, that kind of thing. None of that business really makes any difference to you at all. In fact, what I generally tell people is, if you're going to buy it locally, go to the store and probably the least expensive package that they have for sale there will do just fine for what you want to do with it. The problem is you may find that you'll get it. And then you'll find out there are all kinds of interesting things to do, and you'll wish that you had gotten more. But if you're pretty sure that all you're going to do is that basic stuff, you ought to be just fine.
What about manipulating photographs?
I think
I edit a newsletter where we put a number of photographs in.
I think that and with one codicil here, get an adequate amount of RAM. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to sell you. Let's assume you're buying a Windows XP machine.
It'll run Linux.
And they're going to sell
he's
you
going
one.
To Linux. Wow.
Oh, he's going to Linux. Okay. Well, Mark could probably tell you more about what you need capacity-wise in that way. But RAM, I think, is a bigger factor there than those processors. Again, I think either one of those processors, if you're just going to be doing a little digital photo manipulation, you're probably fine.
256 megabytes of RAM?
That's generally adequate for Linux. Linux is a little more efficient than Windows at using your system resources adequately. However, RAM is so ridiculously cheap. One of the things that I would look for in a computer is one that is expandable. A lot of systems are designed to not take much more RAM than they come with, but some systems can take a lot more RAM, and Linux can actually utilize additional RAM in ways that Windows cannot. So there may be situations where you can get some real performance for very low cost by adding a lot of RAM to a Linux system. For one thing, Linux can be loaded from a RAM disk, so you can load your entire operating system into RAM as if it were your hard drive. And so if you put a gigabyte or a gig and a half of RAM on a machine, which is not really that expensive these days if you shop around for your RAM, you can really make a Linux box scream. And Microsoft has designed Windows so that it boots from drive C and nothing else, and it's very hard to make Windows do tricks like that.
I know I can get 500 megabytes in it. I think probably it would go more. It's, I think, about $60 more for another 256. Would be cost effective?
If you get 500, you're doing good.
Yeah, I wouldn't look to start out with a lot of memory, but just note what type of memory it is. Memory's getting cheaper all the time. 512 megabytes of SD RAM, last time I checked the price, was around $30. And one of the things you want to watch out for is a lot of the big companies that sell RAM, they buy it once a year, and the price that they're charging you is usually last year's price, and at the rate RAM prices have been dropping, to buy RAM with your computer, you're going to pay 2 to 10 times what you can buy it on the aftermarket from even, you know, well, I won't name vendors, but, you know, local retailers and their rebate deals and so forth, or directly off some of the Internet sites that specialize in RAM. It's really become a commodity like corn and beans, and, you know, today's price is often far more attractive than the, you know, big companies that set a price once or twice a year, and that's what they bundle.
So make sure that all of the RAM is on one SIM if possible?
Yes, and just check, you know, if you have a choice between motherboards, I would spend a little extra money to get a motherboard that has 3 or 4 sockets for additional RAM chips than a motherboard that only has 2.
I think it has 3, but I'm not sure.
3 is good. 3 is good.
Any potential gotchas in motherboards?
I would... If you're a serious computer user, I would search for some of the review sites, especially some of the overclocking sites. They do some really good reviews of motherboards, and I always feel that if an overclocker has cranked a board up to its limits and found it still performed well, that's a good indication that without pushing it to its limits, it's going to be very reliable.
Can you explain what that is? Overclocking?
Yes. Overclocking is... you modify the parameters in the motherboard as far as clock speed and so forth to get the computer to perform faster than it was designed to. And this is not something you want to just experiment without a little research, because without proper cooling and monitoring, you can physically damage the equipment doing this. However, with that caveat, if you verify that you have the proper cooling, you might need a higher grade heatsink and fan on the processor chip, for example. A number of processors can be run faster than they were designed to run, and do it fairly well. And
so don't try this at home, folks. But for those reviews that have done that, you can get some good information.
Yes. Well, the thing is, we all know how unstable Windows systems can be at times. And I'm sure a lot of people have used computers over the years, have had a system that just for one reason or another seems to lock up more often than others. And sometimes these are due to hardware flaws in the motherboard or an interaction between the motherboard and the processor or something like that. And when you overclock a system, you stress it in such a way that these kinds of problems happen more frequently. And so I think is a very good way, you know, unless you've used something for a couple of years, you really don't have a feel for how reliable it is. So for new products, one of the easiest way to get a feel for how reliable they're going to be is to stress them a little bit and see how well they behave under stress. And I'm not a big advocate of overclocking, but I really do like the overclocker sites because when they review boards, they stress them and they tell you at what point they start failing and how they fail. And so if you really want a quality motherboard, I find that that's a very good way to, it's very easy to go to a search engine and search for overclock and the name of the particular motherboard you're looking at, and very quickly you'll find three or four websites that have reviewed the board, and, you know, somebody has spent a good week playing with that board and will compare and contrast its features with other systems and give you some really good information on a specific board.
How much memory would you need to use a RAM disk for the system?
Well, for Linux, you don't need a heck of a lot because Linux you can run a Linux system off of three floppies. You don't need a whole lot of RAM. Now, you know, if you're going to be doing serious photo editing and stuff, you need a fair amount of RAM for all that kind of stuff or some other storage. You have a lot of. You said you were thinking of doing a lot of this work under Linux, and that gives you a lot of flexibility that you don't necessarily have under Windows that has very rigid parameters of how they handle virtual memory and real memory and disk access.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the questions. We have another caller. I want to, if we have time, talk more about Linux because I think it's an intriguing alternative to the rest of the computer world. But let's first take this caller who's been waiting patiently on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
My problem is the quantity of commercials that I am getting on AOL. The other day, a commercial appeared in the middle of a screen, and I had no way of getting rid of it, so I couldn't read the article. What can I do about this?
You and a lot of other people would like to be able to answer that question. I know that there are in a general email sense, in a web sense, there are little utilities you can get that block banner ads and block pop-up ads and filter junk email and that kind of thing. I don't know whether those things exist for AOL, but I would suspect that they do. And I'll make the good suggestion that Mark always makes. If you went to Google and you typed in, you know, AOL ad blockers or something like that, I bet you'd find some of those things that you could download and install.
Okay.
Do you guys know of anything in specific?
I hate to slam AOL because it is the most popular ISP.
But go ahead.
But a number of other competitors to AOL have been advertising that they don't throw advertising at you as part of the ISP service, and they actually help you block unwanted advertising. So you might consider another internet service provider. Now, most websites that you go to, they have their own advertising, and it doesn't matter what internet service provider you use. So it's not AOL's fault most of the time when you're using a web browser. It's the advertising that's associated with the web page if it's coming up in another browser window.
Well, we like AOL, except for this one thing. And so we'll stick with it, but see if we can't work with them to get rid of some of it. I have another question. Can I answer it?
Sure, go ahead.
Am I taking too much of your time?
No, go right ahead.
I have a Maxtor 20-gig hard drive I just installed in my gateway, and it's running. Well, it's after it runs a while, it starts a high whine. I don't know anything I can do to fix that. I called the company, and they said, run a utility on it. Now, how do I run a utility?
It'd be like disk scan wouldn't, or defragging it probably
wouldn't. Well, I do that
yeah.
regularly, and when the wine gets too bad, then I run it again. And it's not constant. It only when it gets warmed up. Maybe it's
could be a physical issue.
Yeah,
that sounds very odd to me because, you know, generally the disc utilities are for how the data is laid out on the disc, the integrity of the operating system, file structure, and so forth. A wine is usually caused by bad bearings, which is a hardware flaw in the drive. And if it's under warranty and it's already making a lot of noise and it's brand new, I would try and get them to exchange it for another drive.
It's only about 6 months old, so I'll look into that.
One other thing you might think about, is the caller still on the line?
Yes.
Cooling. How many cooling fans do you have in the case of your computer? Most cases are designed for an extra cooling fan or two, and if you only have the fan in your power supply and that fan's getting a little dirty and slowing down a little bit, the drive may not be getting adequate cooling. And it is normal for drives when they exceed their normal heat parameters to fail, actually. You know, how mothers will put their hand on a child's forehead to see if it's healthy. Well, computer geeks put their hand behind the computer and feel the air coming out. And if there's not a lot of air that's reasonably cool and not real hot, you want to make sure you have adequate cooling in your case. And for $2 to $5, you can go to local stores and pick up extra fans to put in your case to blow a little more air through and help with the cooling. And so I just wanted to point out that it may not be the drive, it could be the cooling system in the case of your computer that could also be the problem.
Well, thank you very much. That's a place to start.
Okay, good luck. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
We have a couple other callers waiting. Let's go next to someone on our toll-free line number 4. Good morning, you're on Focus 580.
Hi. How critical is it to keep a magnetic memory storage disk above freezing temperature? If the data is still good after one cold spell, might another cold spell damage it? Or how critical is that?
I think if the system is off, it's not going to hurt it. You just want to make sure that you have adequate time to return a system to room temperature. So if you ship a computer and it happens to be on a truck with very cold weather, I don't think that's going to hurt it, but when you get it in the house, you don't want to turn it on right away when it's ice cold inside because moisture will condense as the fans pull the air through, and you can get water damage inside the computer that way.
So warm up the disk before you put it in the computer.
Oh, are you talking about a floppy disk?
Well, three and a half inch disk.
Yeah, that's not so much an issue. That I wouldn't worry about that too much. I mean, I wouldn't leave it sitting outside covered with frost and then put it right in the computer. But, I mean, if it's been in your coat pocket or your bag, it should be fine to use right away.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Quick follow-up to that. We did a program a couple weeks ago about air travel, and it seems we had a lot of questions about flash cards, I mean, like the smart media cards and other kind of computer media and the effect of the X-ray security devices on those. Do any of you know anything about the effect of X-rays that, you know, in airline security on those types of things?
Well, previously, you know, there was people worried about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was really kind of an urban legend in a sense. Yeah. You know, it just wasn't powerful enough that it was going to happen. Now, though, I've seen increased concern because, you know, they're jacking up everything. But again, I don't know in this case whether that's another urban legend or not.
Okay.
I have not read stories of people who had, you know, their hard disks erased by being scanned at the airport.
Okay.
Now, hard drives are shielded anyhow. They're encased in a metal case, so they're relatively well protected. And X-rays are not magnetic rays,
right.
they're not likely to damage magnetic media. I've not had problems. I've taken my laptop's been X-rayed a bazillion times as I've been traveling, and my digital camera has not had any problems going. You know, I've taken pictures in the airport and gone through security with the camera, and it's fine. So I haven't experienced any problems myself.
Okay, good to know. We have another caller.
They're probably going to make you turn it on. Sorry, Jack.
Yeah,
they're probably going to make you turn it on these days, too,
right.
Which means you're not necessarily going to be running it through a machine. You're going to have to get it out and show it to somebody.
So. Yeah, because they want to make sure it really is a computer.
Yeah.
All right. All right, let's talk with our next caller. This is someone on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Yes.
I got two comments from earlier ones, and one is just that last caller. It's something in the back of my head. I'm no physicist. But magnetism, I thought, weakens with heat, not cold. So I would think that you could, you know, put your floppies in a freezer and they'd be just fine. The other was an earlier caller said something about using keypad responses, controls buttons in order to avoid the mouse. And you mentioned something, a control D, I think it was?
Windows D.
Windows D, that's it. Thank you.
So you have to have a new keyboard. Yeah, that's the – it toggles clear desktop. It'll minimize everything on your desktop at once, which can be really handy if you got a bunch of windows open and you want to close them all at once.
This is a problem I have trying to run a hard disk cleanup thing, whether it's Norton or it's the Windows utility, and it will keep stopping because something keeps writing to the disk.
Okay, Windows D is not going to help you because applications are still running, they're just minimized.
How can I find what is writing to the disk?
The easiest way to deal with that is to boot up in safe mode. Most versions of Windows have an option to start up in a safe mode that prohibits any other programs from running.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the flavor of Windows, there are various techniques you can use to figure out what's running in the background. But easiest thing to do is just run in safe mode.
Okay. I've used the Control-Alt-Delete combination, and it'll come up and say, you know, give me a window that says, here are things that are running, and I can end tasks. Seems to shut each one down one at a time.
Right.
But I've shut down just about everything, and it keeps on having this, something's writing to your disk. And the only one that I can't seem to turn off is the Windows Explorer itself, and then if I try to do that, it says, I'm going to shut down your computer.
Right.
Do you use a screensaver?
Yeah.
Turn it off.
Okay.
I bet that solves your problem.
All righty. I'll try that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
But if that doesn't work, safe mode is the easiest way to make sure nothing else is writing to your disk.
Yeah. I've encountered a number of problems with screensaver programs. They seem to be kind of, you know, things that cause problems. Has that been your experience?
It seems to be another process that interrupts another process that you're using. If you're using a CD writer on an earlier machine, I've often had problems with it interfering with that because it will demand just a hint of the processor time to interrupt that. Now, that's older machines today. There's probably not much problem with that. If you're running a scan disk, you may have a problem when your screensaver starts up because you're accessing the disk you're scanning, and it may have to start over from scratch. So they often do interrupt things that run automatically, automated processes. It can cause some problems.
The other thing is a screensaver really necessary anymore with newer monitors?
No.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I thought. Because
simple,
it won't.
No, it's not necessary.
I mean, it used to be the case that, you know, the pixels would burn into the actual screen,
right.
And that's why you wanted a screensaver to save your screen, but you don't really need that anymore.
No, screensavers are purely an entertainment
function
at this point in time. Yeah. If you like watching flying toasters or whatever the latest screensaver is, they can be very entertaining, some of them.
I'm akin to the toaster.
We have about 10 minutes left with our guests. We're talking about what's new in personal computers and Macs. We haven't talked about Macs yet. Maybe we'll do that in the time remaining. Our guests are Greg Klein, staff writer for the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette, also Mark Zinzo and Phil Ryder from the Computing and Communication Services Office at the University of Illinois. We have a couple of callers to talk with. Let's go next to someone on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, I just have, a quick question. I'm looking at what is a good source for reviews of everything from software to hardware updates for those of us who are sort of partially computer literate, but, you know, sometimes I get pretty maxed out in terms of my understanding.
Sure. Somebody want to tackle that?
Google.
Google. Google.com is a great, great, great search engine.
Seriously, if you're looking for a review on a specific piece of hardware, typing the name or model number of the hardware and adding the keyword review will often take you right to a review that's been published on the Internet somewhere.
Hmm. Do you think that's better than, like, one of the magazines comes out? There's a lot of them, everything I can think of, like PC computing to I don't know, even some of the money magazines have reviews.
Well, the Ziff Davis and CNET sites both have excellent reviews. Google will often find them there, but you can also search the website, which is a lot easier than searching through a bookshelf of magazines.
Okay.
Yeah, and in essence, you know, you often you'll get the review from the magazine on the web.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
So you've saved yourself the price of a magazine. Although I have nothing against magazines, and I like to read them myself, but, you know, it's not necessary.
Okay. That's all. Thank
okay.
You.
Thanks for the call. CNET.com seems pretty good. Yeah, I look at that sometimes.
I think it's excellent.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah, and ZDNet and ZDTV I also like a lot, mm-hmm. too.
Good. We have another caller on line number 3 next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
I have a question. I have a computer in a room that's fairly cool, and so I always figured that I shouldn't really run it. I think the manual or something says you can go down to 40 degrees Fahrenheit, but I always figure the hard drive probably doesn't care for that low temperature for lubrication or whatever, and so I tend to try and get it warmed up to 60. Now, what do you think is a temperature you should, the lowest temperature you probably could run it without doing any damage?
And if you're comfortable sitting in front of the computer at 40 degrees, I think the computer's going to be just fine. It's adequate cooling is one of the hardest things to achieve in a computer, and 40 degrees is not going to hurt it. It's only when you get to the point where water is condensing in the components that you really have to worry. You know, as long as you're within the manufacturer's specs, running it on the cool end of those specs is probably better for it than running it at room temperature.
I think that, you know, goes back to what Mark was saying earlier. It may not be the low temperatures so much as the change in temperature and the rate that the temperature's changed. If you move a machine from 40 degrees to 80 degrees quickly, you may get some condensation in the components that you want to avoid turning it on at that point.
Now, one caveat is I've seen systems that if they're normally used at one temperature, won't read and write reliably at another temperature. So, for example, everybody knows that temperature causes things to expand and contract, and the tolerances on hard drives are very fine these days, and there's a little bit of slop in those tolerances, but if the drive is having problems, heat can exacerbate those. And in the early days of PCs, I read articles about people who would put computers in the icebox in order to extract the data off of them because they were having trouble running at warm temperatures, but they were still readable at low temperatures.
But it makes a good point. Generally, your problem is more likely to be excessive heat than to be excessive cold. Just because the computer is probably, as Mark said, more tolerant of the cold than you are sitting there.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have just about 5 minutes left and open lines if anybody wants to ask a question in the time remaining. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I'm intrigued a little bit by our discussion earlier of, we're getting callers already, Linux. So I'll just squeeze in this question real fast. And I think a lot of people, you know, have sort of heard about Linux, but, you know, they think, well, Windows, you know, or Mac, you know, OS is so ubiquitous that, you know, Linux may sound intimidating also. Do you think that there are good reasons for people to consider Linux as an operating system on the computer?
There are a lot of good reasons. First of all, Linux is much more reliable and gives you a lot more performance from your system. The only trouble with Linux is there's still a fairly steep learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
If you've had exposure to Unix in the past, Linux is going to be a very powerful tool for you. If you only have had experience with point-and-click GUI operating system interfaces, Linux is getting very close to the point where it's going to be fairly friendly, but it's not 100% there yet. Some of the distributions of Linux are getting to the point where you can install them without having special expertise, mm-hmm. and you will get a nice point-and-click GUI interface. One of the problems is a lot of manufacturers are not supporting Linux. So you buy a new video camera, it comes with a driver just for Windows and not for Linux. And while a lot of people are writing things, it's generally the older hardware that is best supported by Linux. because there's a time lag between when the manufacturer releases the product with the Windows drivers and the Linux hackers have a chance to figure out how to make it work under Linux.
Yeah, but a lot of that is being developed, and there's more and more available for Linux, would you say?
Yes.
Okay. Well, suddenly our lines are all full, and I know we're not going to be able to take everybody. We'll try to do our best. We'll go next to line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, I have a question. My PC machine, when I turn it off, it turns right back on. And in order to get it to completely shut off, you have to disconnect it from the power source completely. Do you have an idea of how I can fix that?
I would say it's probably a bad power supply. By any chance, I'm just curious, what is the brand name of your computer?
It's an E-Machine.
Yeah.
And I've heard that other people having the same problem.
E-Machines are notorious for having poor power supplies. If it's under warranty, that's
not under warranty. Yeah.
If it were under warranty, I would say try and get it fixed. The E-Machines machines are so cheap that it's probably not worth the cost of a replacement power supply. Also, the E-Machines power supplies are not standard power supplies, and you can't buy a good quality off-the-shelf power supply because it won't fit in the box.
Okay, so you suggest just either dealing with it or buying a new machine.
Yeah, or a $2 power strip that, you know, gives you a switch behind the computer that you use instead.
Just turn it off that way.
Just put a $2. My mother has the same problem. And we just put a power strip behind the computer, and we turn it off at the power strip to make sure it stays off when we want it off.
Okay. That's basically what I did with it, but I just wonder if there was a way to fix it.
Okay.
And replace the power supply, which is about somewhere between a $30 and a $70 item.
Yeah. Let's squeeze in at least one more caller here. Next, line number two. Good morning.
Hi.
Yes.
A question about, can you tell me what I'm going to, what difference I'm going to see in a AMD 1 gigahertz processor as opposed to a Pentium 4, which I think is 1.6 processor. What's going to be different?
Obviously, a little bit of speed, but not much. Mainly, you'll probably look at the price difference. The AMD processors are excellent. Now, moving up to a Pentium 4 in Intel, you may get a little extra graphical audio capabilities, but not much more for your money. It depends on what you're trying to do with it.
If you want a detailed answer, go to AMD.com to see where the Athlon shines. They'll have a lot of benchmarks, and they'll highlight the applications where they outperform the Pentium, and vice versa. If you go to the Intel.com, they'll have a lot of benchmarks for their processor showing what sorts of things it outshines, and there'll be very specific details there.
But just for standard, you know, use, home use and that sort of thing.
Well, the megahertz is a rough indication. I mean, obviously, a 1 gigahertz processor is going to be slower than a 1.6 gigahertz processor, whether it's AMD or Pentium. However, there are a lot of factors in the architecture of the processor, pipelining, how many things it can do in a single instruction that make a big difference, too. So without actually doing some research and looking at benchmarks, it's very hard to compare processors based just on megahertz or class of processor.
I'm sorry to say that we're out of time, and there are a couple other callers I must apologize to, but we will do this again. We could probably spend a couple hours talking about this at least. But for now, we'll have to call the proceedings to a halt and thank our guests, Greg Klein, staff writer for the Champaign-Urbana News-Gazette, and also look for the circuits section of the News-Gazette. Comes out on Mondays, and Greg has a column that runs in there and also writes on technology issues. Greg, do you have you want to give out your email address for questions for your column?
They can just, it's Klein, K-L-I-N-E, at news-gazette.com. And they can also see the column at www.news-gazette.com.
Very good. And also Mark Zinzo and Phil Ryder from the Computing and Communication Services Office at the University of Illinois. The website there also has a number of resources for people. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.